This episode of The Sit-Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. The leaves are rustling, the temperatures are lowering, and football is here. I love gambling, I love fantasy, and I know a lot of you do too. Here at The Sit-Down, we feel that our subject matter and gambling go hand in hand. There's a new app out there, though, that can get you involved in not only fantasy, but gambling too. Let me introduce you to Thrive Fantasy, the newest in prop-style gambling fantasy. Right now, by going to thrivefantasy.com or downloading the app wherever you get your apps, you can join for real cash prizes in multiple different sports, whether it's football, the NBA, when that's in season, soccer, or even cricket. You can get involved now by picking fantasy-style props each week, and whoever gets the most right wins the cash prizes. They have entry fees from $5 all the way up to $10,000. Be like me. Go to Thrive Fantasy and get in the game today. Week one, they had $100,000 in prizes. And as I said, they have weekly prizes every single week. You got Monday night games. You got Thursday night games. You got Saturday games. You got Sunday games. All sorts of great contests. Now, the Jacksonville Jaguars are official sponsors of Thrive Fantasy. The LA Chargers are official sponsors of Thrive Fantasy. And so is the Sit Down Podcast. So be like me. And go get involved right now with Thrive Fantasy. Get the app wherever you get your apps.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a Mafia History podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. I hope you're having a great day wherever you are. We are here for yet another episode. The episodes are coming fast and furious. Got a lot going on right now, but I always enjoy the time we have when we sit down, relax, we get our guy we're going to talk about or girl we're going to talk about and have some fun. Always a great time of the week. Let's bring in our consigliere, our co-host, great Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, how you doing? We had a gigantic episode last week. It was well received, and now we're going to kind of do the double part of the duo, Meyer Lansky, this week on The Sit Down. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, brother. I'm good. It's always good to be here, and you know, I'm really excited for this one because you know, as much as Lucky Luciano is, as we said last week, you know, kind of the founding father of the American Mafia, if you will. Meyer Lansky's a really interesting guy, not only for his role with Lucky, but, you know, his involvements in, you know, making Las Vegas what it is today and his run with Bugsy Siegel. He's a really interesting guy. So there's a lot to get into here about Meyer Lansky.
Yeah, Meyer's a guy that exhumes the earner status, right? I mean, he was definitely a guy that – really, when we look back on non-Italian individuals, I don't know if, in fact, I don't think there was a bigger individual in the mob ever than Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky was not Italian. I think when you're asking me, I would put, you know, Jimmy Burke up there, and I would put Meyer Lansky up there. Yeah. We obviously know that in the early 20s and the teens, I think if you were willing to do business with people like Jewish people and other, you know, Irish and things of that nature, you were going to make a whole lot of money. And like Lansky or like Luciano, who obviously they were friends, they both followed in the footsteps of Arnold Rothstein, who, as we said, was a gigantic bootlegger and made a ton of money. But yeah, as you said, you know, Meyer was heavily involved, obviously, in Cuba. He was heavily involved with Las Vegas and kind of making that what it is. But one thing that I always loved about Meyer is he is obviously very much connected to gambling. And, you know, when you're looking at legalized, not or illegal gambling and gambling in general, the casino industry, Meyer was huge in that. I mean, he really realized that there are places in America that were willing to put up with gambling as long as you cut them in on it and gave them a kickback. And you know, even places like Saratoga, which I know you're familiar with, Blackjack, up in New York. I mean, one of Meyer's first operations was in Saratoga. It was a place where he would find these locations that they kind of looked the other way, right? They were kind of these mini Vegases in a way. So maybe there were places where bootlegging was big and you threw kind of gambling in there as well. New Orleans was another hot spot, kind of that city of sin in a way. And, you know, Meyer not only made tons of money there, he was also, like Luciano, involved with the United States government in World War II. And as we know, and we'll get into this a little bit, he's probably the only mobster ever that had compromising photos of a major American, you know, law enforcement member, frankly. And we'll get into that as well. So a lot to get into. And Blackjack, I guess we'll also ask, when he died, what was his financial situation? Because a lot of people wonder how badly he actually got cleaned out by Cuba and Fidel Castro. And, you know, the legend would have it, and I'm lended to believe that in multiple books, it has been clearly stated that Meyer Lansky's net worth was grossly exaggerated, and whether he actually had a lot of money or he didn't. So there's so much to peel back. And I got to tell you, I have so much good information. I think this will be the most complete Lansky episode you'll hear on Meyer. So what do you say we get into it? How was your week, Blackjack, by the way?
Fantastic, buddy. I mean, what's not to like? It's fall. The weather's getting a little bit cooler. You know, things are just nice. Football's back. Hockey's back now. It's a good time of year.
Yeah, I will say one thing that I've noticed, and we get this occasion. I don't know how much you get it down in Florida, but obviously up here, it has been cloudy, Blackjack, around here for like 2 weeks straight. And we're going through this. You know about this Mercury retrograde. Do you know about that?
I have no idea, Jeff. That sounds like something out of a...
Yeah, so it's this like thing that like it kind of affects people's moods, and we have it like every year, and it's just kind of in over my head. But I'm noticing that it's just been cloudy for like 2 weeks straight. I never really realized, you know, I often think like, how do people live places where it's cloudy all the time? It just kind of gets you down after a while, even if you're like super positive. But
I don't know how people live in Seattle.
Yes, exactly.
Because, you know, we get 300 days of sunshine a year here in Florida. They get 300 days of rain.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. It's real tough. All right. Let's get into it. As always, make sure you give us a follow on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Check us out on YouTube as well, the Sit Down. I'm throwing up weekly videos on there, just kind of short videos, kind of going over smaller mobsters. You know, and obviously, if you know someone that you think might enjoy the show, make sure you tell them about it. All right, let's get into it. Meyer Lansky on the Sit Down. Meyer Suchalansky was born July 4th, 1902 in Grodno, which would be in Belarus. Now, if you know anything about Russia at the time, Belarus was not a country. It was part of the USSR, obviously. Today, Grodno is in Belarus. It's very close to the western border with Poland and Lithuania. It's a pretty nice little city, and that's where Meyer Lansky was actually born. He was the son of Polish Jews. They had kind of went over, and remember, at that time, it was all kind of one big country. At 7 years old, Meyer's father would actually leave Grodno and go to America. He, in those days, as we know, there were all sorts of Europeans coming over, and some of them were leaving, as far as the men in the family, were leaving before their family, making sure they, you know, could have some success. And his father would leave, and 2 years later, him, his brother, and his mom would join their father in Manhattan. And Lansky would emigrate through the port of Odessa into the United States, and they would actually settle in Brownsville, Brooklyn. For a lot of, at least the early years from Meyer Lansky, Meyer came over when he was 9 years old. For the first couple of years, him and his family lived in Brownsville, and his dad was a garment presser. And eventually, some financial difficulty would hit the family, like a lot of immigrant groups were being hit with. And Meyer's father would move his family to the Lower East Side. Now, obviously, in those days, the Lower East Side was a very small corridor. There were a lot of people living there. It was Italians, it was Jews, it was Irish, it was all immigrant, and it was a tough place to grow up. Meyer's family would settle initially at 546 Grand Street, then they would move to 552 Grand Street, and he would live there for most of his early teens and obviously into his 20s. Meyer Lansky would attend PS 34, and all indications were he was a really smart kid. He got good grades. He had this intellectual side to him. He was soft-spoken. He was well-spoken. And he was a great student. And, you know, Blackjack, I got to be honest, in the 28 episodes we've done, 27 episodes, I cannot fathom and remember one person that had success early on in school.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right going back through them in my head. No, most of them really struggled, you know, with any schooling that they had, and most didn't attend very often. So, yeah, I think that there's a little bit of an outlier there.
Yeah, Lucky would talk, or Meyer Lansky would tell a story about when he was a child, Blackjack, that times were tough on the Lower East Side, and his mother would send him to the bakery. She would make stew. It was a very simple thing to make. It was cheap, and it fed a lot of people. His mother would give him a nickel and send him to the bakery to get fresh bread and other little things for the stew. He would talk about, this was his first foray into gambling. He talked about he would walk there, and one day he saw a dice game that was going on the corner, and he entered the dice game and immediately lost the nickel, and he had to go home in shame and tell his mother what happened. And he talked about from then on, he knew that he would never be a gambler, and he would always be the guy that helped gamblers or gave them an option to be gamblers. He always would tell his kids, his grandkids, you cannot make money gambling. Everybody loses. And he had to take that really hard as a child in losing really what little money they had. He lost it in a dice game. Lucky would graduate school in eighth grade in 1917, and that would be the last time he would attend school. He would leave and go get a job at a place called D&L Tool. It was on Canal Street and Center Street, really not far from his home on the Lower East Side. After work, though, like any kid in his teenage years, he would run the streets. He belonged to a small gang, and that's where he would meet his two best friends. He would meet Charles Lucky Luciano, and he would also meet his best friend, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel. Bugsy Siegel would actually live not far away. The family, once Meyer got into his teenage years, would move to 6 Columbia Street. Meyer and the family would live there, and Bugsy lived at 36 Columbia Street. So they would all kind of live near each other. They all went to the same synagogue. And that's where it all started, Blackjack. These guys were friends really from their adolescence. And, you know, they would run the streets. They would work, you know, kind of helping out union officials and things of that nature. Meyer would be called a shtarka, which in Yiddish is enforcer. He would protect gambling spots. He would, again, be recruited, like I said, by different union organizers to kind of, you know, take care of little quarrels and, you know, beat up on people. And there was actually a situation in Meyer's right around like the 1918-19 a year. There was a factory that a union official wanted to take care of. I guess this factory was being picketed in upstate New York, and Meyer and a friend were sent to kind of deal with the main foreman on the job and kind of beat him up and get him out of work so this place could close. And that's really when Meyer Lansky became kind of a full-fledged criminal. So when you hear about Meyer, Blackjack, you always hear that he never actually killed anybody. But in his early days, Meyer was a shtarka. He was an enforcer. He was someone that even at 5'4", 5'5", had a lot of moxie and was a tough kid in all honesty.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting fact about him, honestly, because as you said, most people talk about him as, you know, the accountant for the mob, or, you know, just a businessman. And that's obviously what he spent most of his life doing. But, you know, coming up early on, he wasn't afraid to mix it up if he needed to. And, you know, the partnership between him and Siegel and him and Luciano is really fascinating to me, Jeff, because I don't think we've talked about a bond that was that impenetrable, that's not familial, right? Like, I mean, these guys have no relation to one another whatsoever, and they stuck it out together their entire lives.
Yeah, the only one that I know of is in Philadelphia, which we've talked about, the Joey Molino group. They've known each other their whole life. They grew up, you know, on, you know, Jackson Street and Snyder Avenue in that area. That's the only one I know of, guys that have been friends forever, and they're kind of like impenetrable in the way. They're just friends. They're like brothers. But you're right. This is the only kind of relationship like that. You know, usually these guys, you know, maybe they find a mentor and they have friends, you know, into their 20s or something. But these guys are friends really from their early teenage years or mid-teenage years. That's a good point by you. Obviously, in 1920, Meyer Lansky is 18 years old and prohibition starts. And we've talked about that, the Volstead Act. Money starts flowing. And we all know in New York, it started flowing. Meyer Lansky actually meets Arno Rothstein at a bat mitzvah. And he becomes close with the bootlegger. Obviously, as we said in the Lucky episode, Arnold Rothstein was a smart guy because he obviously had his own organization, but he was getting these young kids who kind of had a something to them. He gave them kind of the backing financially and said, look, go out and do your own thing. I'll be the bank. And that's something that Meyer quickly got into. Him and Bugsy Siegel would actually get a car rental business that it would use as a front for bootlegging alcohol, which would be at Delancey and Clinton Streets right in the Lower East Side. And it's funny because from what I understand, their organization and operation out of that car rental place was literally like right down the street from the police precinct. And it was always kind of funny that they were able to kind of do this all under the very close eye of the police. But, you know, again, we see that same name, Blackjack, Arnold Rothstein. He really was a guy that I think molded a lot of these kids, these young guys, particularly Meyer Lansky, because Meyer, unlike Siegel and Luciano, from a business and from a intellectual standpoint, he was the one that really reminded you of Rothstein. He was kind of the real young version of him. He had the mind, he had the numbers. You know, he was a smart guy. He was kind of that uppity, higher class kind of guy. He didn't really act like it though, but they had the same kind of a business-like mind. These guys would make a ton of money, and eventually Meyer would kind of go into what he knew best, which was gambling. And you know, they were running little halls, you know, poker games, crap games, all sorts of different haunts of that nature. But obviously, as the 20s are happening and they're making money in prohibition, Lucky Luciano is getting stronger and stronger, as we know. And he would obviously foray into, once Rothstein dies, they would kind of take over Rothstein's operations, and that's where all the Masseria and Maranzano starts. But remember, Meyer Lansky was Luciano's trusted ally. He was his most trusted confidant. And if we remember, when Maranzano was whacked, Meyer Lansky was the one that really kind of set that in motion, Blackjack, with the hitters, because Maranzano would have recognized them.
Yep, that's right. I mean, guys certainly was helpful in a lot of different ways, right?
Yeah, he really was. And he was good at kind of being in this, you know, back scene and being powerful and kind of having other people do his bidding in a way. But as obviously Maranzano and Masseria are eliminated, Lucky becomes the boss of the entire thing, the Capo di Tutti Capi. He runs the Luciano crime family. And as we know, Lucky can't make Meyer and Bugsy, but they're very close to his operation, probably more powerful than most of the individuals in the operation. In the early 1930s, Meyer would really move into gambling. He realized that places like Saratoga up in New York were rife with, they were kind of these little towns that would kind of look the other way when it comes to gambling. They were willing to take the piece. And I don't know kind of how to relate Saratoga. Can you explain Saratoga, Blackjack, the kind of town that it is? Maybe not now, but it's kind of one of those, like, not outlaw towns back then, but it was kind of like Atlantic City, except there was no beach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think that, you know, it's just one of those places that, you know, and the racetrack probably has something to do with that too. But, you know, it's one of those places that, and upstate New York, for people who aren't familiar with upstate New York, you have a lot of these kind of little towns up there that are a little bit, I'm going to use the word redneck, but I'm not saying it in a bad way, but that's just kind of what they are. And it's a place where, yeah, if you wanted to go and set up a little numbers operation, they'd probably be more than okay with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've talked in the Q&As occasionally about Wheeling, West Virginia. I kind of looked at it similar to Wheeling. It was, again, a gambling hub. It had the racetrack, which is huge, but they also had things called lake houses, they would call them. And the lake house was almost a gambling house, pretty much. And alongside Joe Adonis and Frank Costello, Meyer Lansky sets up a small casino called the Piping Rock, which really had, you know, roulette wheels. They had about 12 of them, three craps tables, a card table, and a bird cage. And they made a ton of money, and the money they were making back, the politicians were looking the other way because they had so much connection in those cohorts that they were kicking up a kickback and everybody was making money. And look, it's so close to New York. You can head up there for a weekend. It's kind of the version of Atlantic City, except north, and there's no beach, right? So this was the first foray into gambling. And obviously, as the 30s figure themselves out, they would move down to New Orleans, where they would open nightclubs, and then into Hollandale Beach, which, like Saratoga, was kind of this mecca for looking the other way on things. And in Hollandale, what they did was, to tolerate gambling, they would covertly tax the money they were making through bonds. And it was kind of a kickback that the municipality was making through that source of income. So everybody was making money. Meyer and the boys were making money. He was kicking that back to the mob. And obviously the towns are looking the other way because they were making money as well. It was a brilliant strategy. Yeah. And there was really no gambling going on.
Well, I mean, you'll notice, Jeff, that you've talked about two towns in here, Saratoga and Hallandale Beach. The common thread there is that they both have racetracks, and they both had racetracks at that time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you had Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, obviously Saratoga Racetrack up there. It sends a signal when, I mean, horse racing was the only, I believe, the only legal form of gambling in the country at that point. It sends a signal that we're okay with this, right? Like, we're okay with having gambling in this town. So if you make things worth our while, you might be able to do a little bit more.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously you mentioned racing, which makes total sense, the horse racing thing. A lot of that had to do with a guy that Meyer knew called Lou Smith. Lou Smith was a racetrack owner, and he actually, in the early 40s, him and Meyer would open a Greyhound racetrack in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and that would kind of foray into the connection to Cuba. Lou Smith had a connection in Cuba. He had a contract with the Cuban government to kind of clean up the horse racing business on the island and organize kind of gambling. I think the thought that the Cuban's government wanted was they wanted Cuba to be that Caribbean gambling paradise. I think they realized that people like Lou Smith, people like Meyer Lansky were the ones, and ultimately down the road, Lansky would obviously be successful in doing that. But this is where the connections were made. That guy, Lou Smith, was kind of integral to getting that going. And as you said, a lot of this centered around racing, and it made total sense. Obviously, you have a racetrack. There's an appetite for gambling already. Why not throw in bars and clubs and other gambling joints? And we'll just make sure we kick it back to the government so they make money too, and they don't worry about it. So it made just total sense in all aspects. It was so smart.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, these were the right towns to go to at the right times. Because as you said, there's the appetite, and not only the appetite, but the acceptance of it, right? Like, there was the municipal acceptance of gambling. So it's an easy in if you want to go and set up a little bit of a different operation.
Sadly, though, in the 30s, we all know that one of the very horrific things that was going on in the world was the rise of the Nazi party. And Adolf Hitler was obviously creating these boons, they would call them. And there were people in America that were pro-Nazi, obviously. And Ab Meyer being Jewish, he didn't stand for that. He would also set up things where he would go and attack. He would send thugs of his to attack these Nazis and was really doing some good things. He would talk about the stage would be decorated with a swastika and a picture of Adolf Hitler. The speaker started ranting. There were only 15 of us, but we went into action. We threw some of them out of windows. Most of the Nazis panicked and ran out. We chased them and beat them up. We wanted to show them that Jews would not just sit back and accept insults. So, you know, like Luciano Blackjack, Meyer was doing some great things for the good of the country. Obviously, you know, that's great. And obviously during World War II, he was also integral in helping the United States government in recruiting criminals to watch out for German submarines and things of that nature. These guys were regular patriots. It's interesting that two immigrants were so interested in helping. It's almost great. You'd wish that some of the Americans would take a charge like some of these guys are doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as you mentioned with Luciano, we talked about that last week. He was a significant help to the U.S. war effort in the 40s. And Meyer Lansky was as well. I mean, listen, this was – it's hard for people nowadays to fathom the struggle that this country was in during that time. I mean, we were fighting two of the most difficult wars in our nation's history on two separate continents. We were stretched to the absolute limits here. So, yeah, sometimes you gotta recruit guys that maybe you don't want to do business with. And the government brought in guys like Luciano and Lansky, and they were helpful. I mean, as you said, they were patriots, right? I mean, these were guys who are first-generation Americans. They know what it's like not to be in this country. They know what it's like to have it hard in some, you know, corner of the third world. They didn't want that. So, yeah, they were, for whatever their, you know, their feelings about the government might have been during their normal activities, they were willing to step up and do their duty as Americans during the war.
Yeah, and look, ultimately, through with Lucky and with Meyer, you know, they obviously knew that them doing this would obviously help them in a way. And for Lucky, of course, it helped. One thing that I want to talk about with Meyer Lansky that you always had to find kind of with it was the fact that in all of Meyer's gambling operations, he made it a point to always be on the up and up. It was always about integrity. He was never going to have these cheap clip joints where they would rig stuff against the patrons. You always knew you were going to get a fair game with Meyer. And that was something that I think a lot of people respected as well. This guy was a real gentleman, Blackjack. You know, he...
Yeah, you're right, Jeff, is that, you know, one of the things is that he always wanted these things to be on the up and up. And I think that I don't know, that's something that is speaks to his character, right? I mean, this wasn't someone who was looking for a quick score and to get out. He was looking for a long-term establishment.
Yeah, and that would obviously help him for many years down the road. Now, obviously, as World War II is kind of finishing up, Bugsy Siegel by this point had kind of worried about law enforcement. They were starting to crack down on things, and he eventually goes out to the West Coast. And in the early 40s, he goes to Nevada, Southern Nevada, and kind of starts to realize that this is fertile ground. It was basically a desert at that time. It was a little town, pretty much, you know, horse. Didn't they used to call Las Vegas like a horse, a watering hole or something? It was like it was in the desert.
It was an absolute nothing town. I mean, listen, I know you, I think you've been out to Vegas, Jeff, but I mean,
yep.
For those of you who maybe haven't, you drive 20 minutes outside of Vegas and there's nothing around there. I mean, it's just a strip of highway in the middle of the desert.
And Bugsy Siegel kind of realizes that, hey, they're building this dam out here. Maybe I can start to, you know, we're obviously doing the casinos in Saratoga and all these different places. This would be a fucking huge operation. So Lansky goes to Siegel and says, look, you be my guy out there. You go out there, you make it happen. He starts lining things up in the mid 40s. The problem that he has, though, is he's trying to create this place called the Flamingo Hotel, and he's putting a ton of money into it. He's sinking money that the mob is giving him to kind of put in control and to get this all building. He was putting the most extravagant things in these places. He's putting the best liquor, the best food, the best entertainers, everything. And eventually he started to get to a point where he's just bleeding money. And this started to be a problem for Lansky because, you know, the mob was saying, well, what the fuck's he doing out there? Let's get this thing going. Let's start making money here. Eventually, checks started bouncing. The costs were out of control and he was spending more than he was making. It was just kind of a mess for Bugsy Siegel. He was a little bit in over his head.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that Bugsy was fit for all the roles he assumed in Las Vegas, right? Like, I mean, the Flamingo is still standing today. It's a fine hotel, but it was really like the first of the mega hotels, right? This was a resort hotel in the middle of what would become the Las Vegas Strip, which didn't exist at the time. And yeah, I think Jeff, he was probably just in over his head. I mean, he was managing the construction and development of the hotel. He was dealing with, you know, as you mentioned, food and liquor services, as well as trying to organize entertainment and everything else. I think it probably was a guy wearing too many hats. And, you know, just one other thing, Jeff, you mentioned about like Vegas being kind of like a watering hole town prior to them going out there. The only reason they picked Las Vegas is because you had to drive through it on the way from Chicago to Los Angeles, right? I mean, if you look at a map, and a lot of people would obviously go to and from those cities back then, they were huge cities. You drive right through what is now Las Vegas.
Right. And, you know, by 1947, I mean, he's sinking tons of money into this place. I mean, equivalents, it's basically like $60 million. And from what I know about Bugsy Siegel, he also started like becoming kind of out of control with his reputation. He boasted one day that he personally killed people, and that the head contractor started being concerned over this. He was just kind of being all over the place. He was kind of out of control. And as we know, Luciano sets up the Havana Conference. One of the topics of conversation was, what the fuck is going on in Vegas with Bugsy Siegel? He was out of control, as I said. And, you know, Lansky really went to bat for Bugsy. That was his lifelong friend. And it started getting to a tentative point where it was like, look, he might have to go. And Lansky tries to say, look, you know, let it happen. He's fine. It'll be okay. I believe in him. And after a while, it just said, you know what? He had to go. Siegel would be killed in 1947. And many people would agree that Lansky would have had to substantially agree to it. Like, he was kind of the one that in a way would have to sign off. And we'll talk in a little bit about kind of ultimately way after what he said about all this. Tony Accardo would be integral in taking over what was left of Vegas after Siegel was taken out. Lansky would maintain a large supporting interest in the casinos out there. But once all this happened, Chicago kind of took over. And look, the mob in New York would skim through Vegas for years, but the main people out in Vegas were the Chicago outfit. And from what I know about Lansky, he was very helpful in getting Tony Accardo the keys to the kingdom out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Vegas is pretty much, in my mind, Jeff, always been a Chicago-dominated town. I mean, I know, like you said, the New York families would take a skim of the skim, if you will, but in my mind, Vegas has always been run by Chicago. Like, that's just, ever since it really got going, it's been Chicago.
Yeah, and according to the FBI, Lansky would retain, obviously, that interest for almost 20 years in the Flamingo. So he was still making money. And we'll talk about kind of after everything happens in Cuba. That was really his main source of income after Cuba. Lansky would also say in multiple interviews later in his life that Benjamin Siegel would be still alive today if it wasn't for him. If it were his decision, Siegel's death would mark a power transfer, obviously. And you know, I think it really hit him hard that he had to kill his friend. It's not easy to kill your best friend. And in that life, though, you have to realize that sometimes, you know, you get out of hand, you got to be taken care of. In 1950, the United States would start cracking down on gambling and the mob and things of that nature. Now, it wasn't because Lansky wasn't trying. One of the big thoughts of Lansky was, Blackjack, that he was credited throughout history, and a lot of people wondered why the mob was never really being talked about in the 40s, 50s. There were these crusaders like Thomas Dewey and stuff like that, but the federal government wasn't taking a huge look into the mob. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover, for a long time, would not even recognize the existence of the mob.
Right.
And a lot of people wondered, like, what does the mob have on J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director? He's oddly silent on all this. And many people credit Lansky for having, quote, compromising pictures of a sexual nature of J. Edgar Hoover and his longtime aide, Clyde Toulson. Biographer Anthony Summers, who wrote a book called Official and Confidential, The Secret Life of J. Edgar Hoover, would outline primary sources regarding blackmail that Meyer Lansky would use to gain influence with not only politicians, but the police, with judges, all sorts of things. And a lot of it had to do with Roy Cohen, who we've talked about on this show, great defense attorney in New York. He would have these orgies, frankly. And who shows up one night? J. Edgar Hoover. And they were very secretive. I've heard stories that Hoover was caught in drag, and those only were owned by Lansky. And he used this. He hung it over J. Edgar Hoover's head forever.
Well, yeah, and it makes sense on some level, because if you trace the parties back, you know, it works, right? Like, Roy Cohn was obviously a defense attorney. He was also a homosexual. He also, prior to being a defense attorney, was a United States attorney, prosecuted the Rosenbergs, in fact. So he was part of the government. He was part of, he was an attorney for Joseph McCarthy, which obviously was a cause near and dear to Hoover's heart himself. So it would make some sense that if Roy Cohn was having these parties, it would be a place where Hoover might feel safe, right?
Exactly.
And Clyde Tolson, I mean, I don't think that that's breaking any new ground there. I mean, Clyde Tolson and he were inseparable for most of their adult lives. I mean, they were always seen together having dinner in D.C. They, I mean, for all intents and purposes, lived together. So, yeah, I mean, this does make some sense. Also, the fact that Roy Cohn was tied to Meyer Lansky as sort of, you know, a mentor. Lansky was almost a mentor to Cohn. So the pieces all fit here.
Yeah, they very much do. Now, while this is going on in the late 40s, I was kind of getting to the fact that the government was starting to look more and more into people like Meyer Lansky. They were trying to understand who they were. They were starting to shake them down in a way. And obviously in the 50s, the Kefauver hearings would happen. Lansky would be called to testify on knowledge of underworld people. Obviously, he was around a lot of people. And look, like any great gangster, he doesn't say a word. Lansky would also meet Fulgencio Batista in New York in the late 40s. And that would be a huge relationship that he would have for basically a decade. And in the early 50s, he had to kind of get through some legal problems, Lansky. And then that's when all the Cuba stuff happens. In early 1952, Meyer Lansky would get 3 months for his casino way back in Saratoga. He got jammed up on that. And his whole thing was he never wanted to testify, so he just plead guilty. In this case, he actually had to end up doing 3 months, which was a slap on the wrist. But that's really all the time Meyer Lansky ever did. So one of these people, Blackjack, not quite Tony Accardo, but 3 months in a 70-year life, you know, 60 of it in the illegal mafia trade, pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you can't really complain about that if you're signing up for that life. You know, that's a pretty good deal.
Now, by this time, we obviously had the Havana Conference. The stuff was being in and made to go down to Cuba, and obviously that was the place of the future. We're going to set up hotels. I'm going to sink my whole sum and my fortune, if you're Lansky, into Cuba. In 1952, Lansky would approach then-president Carlos Sicaras, and he would bribe him. Now, this was done kind of behind the scenes. Batista kind of says, look, I want to take control of Cuba. If you go to the president currently and offer him a bribe, he'll step down, no problem. And what that means is you're going to have to put some money out, but I'm going to be in power. And you know what that means? I'll let you do everything. You'll be in control. You'll be the nightlife czar in a way. I'll make you my gambling minister and we'll all make money. So it was a perfect situation. Now, $250,000 Blackjack in 1952. I don't have the inflation on that, but that's a lot of money.
Quite a bit. It's quite a bit. I
mean, that's about $3 million, just south of $2.5 million. That's a lot of money. So he gets this. He goes to the president and says, look, you're a nice guy and all, but we need you out of the way. Here's a bribe. Here's $3 million. Step down. I want my guy in control. He would take the government control in 1952 in March. Batista would lead a coup and kind of go in control of everything. And at that point, he makes Meyer Lansky his gambling czar. Lansky gets a kickback of 25K each year, and he's allowed to kind of go and do whatever he wants, create hotels, create casinos, create everything to make Cuba the gambling destination in the Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the Cuba thing looks like, on the surface, it looks like a really nice setup, right? I mean, you know, you come up with this bribe and you are now involved in Cuban politics on a level where you've got control to do what you want to do to facilitate your interests. I mean, this feels like a great spot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a great deal because in Vegas, you had to go and get gaming licenses. In Cuba, as long as you made an investment, you'd be provided with public matching funds for construction, tax exemption, duty-free importation of equipment and furnishings. And all you had to do is basically pay the government a fee for the license, and there was no background check. You could be whoever you wanted. That was one of the problems. Obviously, if you've ever seen Casino, one of the issues that Frank Rosenthal had was he was always being knocked down on by the state and everybody because of his gambling and his mob connections. Mm-hmm. In Cuba, nobody gave a shit. So you're setting up slot machines and hotels. And keep in mind, all of Meyer's life, work, and money was going into this. But it was a fertile ground where everything was in your hands and you could do whatever you wanted. And that's where a casino would be installed in the Hotel Nacional. And pretty much every place was a gambling mecca. It was truly Las Vegas, except it was in the Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, and that's and I mean, you know, we've talked before about Cuba with the Cuba conference, the Havana conference. It's in the Caribbean, but it's 90 miles from Miami. You know, it's real close.
Yeah, and the casinos that he was installing, like he was putting the best of the best things in them. He was putting central air into these places, which was kind of unheard of. Like they were being done and they were beautiful. They were beautiful buildings. They were beautiful places. And the money just started flowing in. I mean, lawyers would talk about, they were just making tons and tons and tons of money. The government was happy because they were making money. Cuba was a perfect and beautiful place. And I think when we look back, can we honestly say Fulgencio Batista, did he do some things as far as taking money from mobsters? But in a way, wasn't it the best thing possible for Cuba? And ultimately, looking back, it's a shame that he wasn't able to continue.
I mean, I think especially knowing what comes next, there's no way you can possibly argue differently, right? I mean, Batista had his flaws for sure, but the Cuban economy was a hell of a lot stronger under Batista than it's about to be for the next 70 years.
Yeah, and looking back, it's kind of sad, man. Keep in mind, in one casino alone, the slot machines are bringing in approximately $1 million. Now, we don't know if that's monthly. I believe that's monthly. That's pretty incredible. I mean, the take from casinos, we obviously know, is huge. Nobody needs to explain that. But Meyer not only had that, but he had multiple different places down in Cuba that he was working on, whether it was the Comodoro, the Duville, the Sevilla, Biltmore, the Capri. All of the hotels were outfitted in. If you've ever seen Boardwalk Empire, I think it was season 4, Meyer and Nucky actually are in Cuba together and actually run into each other. And you see a young Meyer Lansky, only he's now not young anymore, but he's growing up. And Nucky randomly runs into him and says, "What are you doing down here?" And he goes, "Well, you know, we're putting in all these casinos and we're doing all these things." And it was kind of a cool look. Again, I would love a Meyer and Lucky show. It'd be so great. Yeah. You could do 5 seasons easily through that.
Oh, sure you could.
But obviously in the late 50s, things start to really unravel. The Cuban Revolution would happen in 1959, and we started seeing these revolutionaries come out of the mountains, and the rise of Fidel Castro was starting to happen, and it was really changing the climate in Cuba. On New Year's of 1958, Batista would begin preparing to flee after he found out that the revolutionaries were coming out and they were starting to run into all these towns and were creating their own coup in a way. Batista would end up dying in 1973, but it was starting to come undone. Lansky was celebrating the $3 million he made that year for his operations in one of his hotels. And that night, things started to go horribly wrong. Places were starting to be looted and destroyed. On January 8th, 1959, Fidel Castro would move into Havana and take over, and his command post would be the Hilton Hotel. Meyer Lansky would flee the day before. And I think Meyer started to truly realize this is really bad. A year later, Castro would completely take over and outlaw gambling. So it went from being this place of solitude, of gambling lore, to a communist country that outlaws gambling. The asset base, the revenue streams were completely gone. It's Blackjack, the similar thought of in Breaking Bad when Walter White, remember when that Jack guy comes into the desert and whacks a certain family member and then takes his $80 million or whatever?
Yep.
It's kind of that thought. He makes all this money. He does all this work. He sinks his entire fortune into Cuba. It was presented years later that Meyer Lansky, equivalent to today's standards, lost about $50 million of his own fortune. This was just horrific. And this leads to wonder, obviously Meyer was a rich man, but he got absolutely crushed with Castro taking over. And looking back, it almost, you're almost okay with looking through kickbacks and stuff with mobsters. Cuba was a great place. And as you said, over the next 70 years, it would be transformed into an awful, awful place.
Yeah, I mean, economically, Fidel Castro obviously destroyed Cuba. His human rights track record is atrocious. Everything kind of went to hell in a handbasket there. But as far as Meyer goes, I mean, the amount of money that was lost quite literally overnight is just staggering. I mean, as you said, you know, he put everything he had into this. This was his life now, right? Like, he had left the United States. He went to Cuba. He wanted to set up this kind of Vegas in the Caribbean. And he does it, right? He succeeds. The comparison to the Walter White thing is kind of apt, because he does it. It's successful. It's working. He makes $3 million in the first year. Everything looks great. And then Castro comes in and it all just goes straight to hell. And all of those dollars, all of that work, all of that effort is just gone overnight.
Keep in mind, by October 1960, the Riviera Hotel and 165 other enterprises were confiscated and nationalized. Now, not all of them belong to Meyer Lansky, but most of them belong to Meyer Lansky. And that quick, you go from one day, everything's great, to the next, it's a city burning, and it's now for the next 7-8 decades under communist rule. It's interesting because the U.S. ambassador to Cuba, Earl Smith, would reportedly say that it seems to be the only way we can get honest casinos on doing business with mobsters. Someone asked him how you tolerate gangsters down there, and he said it's the only way we get good business. And looking back, Blackjack, the mob almost. Could we agree that the mob would probably have prevented, if they were able to figure this all out, they could have been heroes in preventing 70 years of oppression?
I mean, I think they certainly would have wanted to, you know. I don't know, Jeff. I don't know enough about what the climate was in Cuba, you know, in terms of what people felt about Castro before he was Castro, if that makes sense. You know, but yeah, I think that if the mob had a real sense of what was about to happen, they probably would have tried something.
Yeah. And as all this happens, in the 60s, Meyer heads back to the United States, and things are starting to come undone a little bit. He becomes the target of FBI surveillance. They obviously know who Meyer Lansky is by now. And in one conversation, he's in a bugged hotel room. He's overheard talking with his wife, commenting that, quote, the mafia in the America is bigger than U.S. Steel, which actually, weirdly enough, was used by Hyman Roth in The Godfather, which we've all seen. And we obviously know that Hyman was a bit of a portrayal of Meyer Lansky, obviously. So you're obviously wondering what happens now, right? Where does Meyer Lansky make money? Because the mob is changing. New York has moved on without him. He's kind of been the guy in the Caribbean, but you know, he obviously had those connections still in Vegas. He had controlling interests in multiple hotels. In 1967, he'd actually sell the Sands Hotel to Howard Hughes, who we all know about. He would make about $1 million there. So, you know, he was still making money, and he had these investments that were worth good money, and he was still skimming profits from Vegas. But, you know, ultimately, by the end of the 60s, you know, he was pretty much out of Vegas. And the big thing next was, well, now what? You know, I'm old. I'm in my 60s. The government's kind of bearing down on me. What do I do now? So in the early 70s, Meyer Lansky's getting sick of, you know, law enforcement. And by this point, the media is all over him. They know who he is. He's kind of being hassled by paparazzi and that sort of thing. So he decides, hey, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to go to a place that I feel like I would love, Israel. And he feels like, you know, he had done stuff over the years with the Israeli government and trying to, you know, create fundraisers to help them out and things of that nature. So he felt like his citizenship would be granted. But they found out who he was. They found out what the word gangster meant. And he would try to soften his image by going on interviews and saying that, you know, newspaper men have it all wrong. And did you ever see that interview, Blackjack, that he did?
I have, yeah. I have.
He's very well spoken. He's talking about the newspaper man.
Incredibly well spoken. And yeah, I mean, Israel obviously allows Jews to come back and resettle there at any point. However, as you said, they do have some discretion in that.
Yeah, and they would cite that Meyer Lansky's criminal past would likely endanger the public welfare, which, look, we obviously know this isn't Roy DeMeo or Tommy Butera or somebody. This is a guy that obviously isn't your typical mobster. He's not technically even a mobster. He's
correct.
A businessman who is connected to the mob and obviously was funneling profits back to them, but he was not a mobster per se. So the Israel stuff doesn't happen. He comes back to Miami, and once returning to Miami, he is hit with a series of indictments, one of which was for tax evasion, based on testimony provided by an individual out of Boston called Fat Vinny Teresa, who claimed that he was delivering profits from gambling in Cuba directly to Lansky in Florida, and that at times Lansky was obviously at other places, and he would, you know, kind of contend that, you know, he was the money man in a way. He was the bag carrier for Meyer Lansky. Ultimately, he would be tried multiple different times, and he would be found not guilty. One other case involved the skimming of Las Vegas casino profits, which by 1976 would be dismissed because of Lansky's poor health. And by that point, he was in his early 70s. And the things were starting to kind of unravel, but they were starting to come undone for Meyer. He was an old man by this point. He was living in Miami, and he spent most of his later years quietly in Miami Beach. On January 15, 1983, at 80 years old, Meyer Lansky would die of lung cancer. He would leave behind his widow and three children and multiple grandchildren. Weirdly enough, the FBI would believe that Meyer Lansky had over $300 million in Swiss bank accounts and other places. Now, it was contended that early in his criminal career, he did set up Swiss bank accounts. Obviously, in the 30s, that was the place to go. Now, keep in mind, that would be equivalent, Blackjack, to about $700 million now. Weirdly enough, a biographer wrote a book about Meyer Lansky, Robert Lacey, and he would contend that Meyer's fortune was grossly exaggerated. And quote, the second wife, her granddaughter would tell author T.J. English that at the time of his death in 1983, Meyer Lansky had only $57,000 in cash, which would be equivalent to about $130,000 today. When asked in later years what went wrong, Meyer would offer no excuses, saying, quote, I crapped out, and that he went as far to tell people that he had lost almost every penny he had in Cuba and was barely scraping by. Now, Hank Messick, a journalist for the Miami Herald, would also investigate Meyer Lansky. He would also contend that, weirdly enough, Meyer Lansky didn't own anything. He owned, quote, people. To him, the FBI and Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, the reality was that Lansky had kept large sums of money in other people's names, and very little was actually in his own name. So he was kind of one of these guys that he had, like, for like standards of like regular people, he was rich. But in the grand scheme of things, for all that he had done, he didn't die with that much money. Now, in kind of the nature of the opposite side, in 2010, Lansky's daughter, Sandra, would state that her father transferred $15 million to her brother's account sometime in the early 70s when Lansky was having problems with the IRS. Now, what really happened, we don't know. But in 2015, Lansky's grandson, Guy Rappaport, once stuff with Cuba started getting better, he asked the Cuban government to confiscate him for the confiscation of the Riviera Hotel that his grandfather built. So the family is still trying to get money back for all this. Now, Meyer, throughout his later life, would try to get money back from Cuba and from the government, from the United States government. Never really happened. But, Black Chuck, I'll ask you, where do you think Meyer sat financially at the end? Because the thought is he got crushed in Cuba.
Yeah, I think both things are true. I think that he did get crushed in Cuba. I think that's true. I think there's no way around that. He was planning on being in Cuba for a long time. He put a ton of money into it, and it evaporated overnight. I think Cuba slammed him. But, you know, Jeff, it's interesting. We talked earlier in the episode about the tie to Roy Cohn and Hoover. Roy Cohn had a similar situation. Roy Cohn never owned a house. He never owned a car. He never had a bank account or a credit card. He kept all his money in other people's names because he wanted to avoid paying taxes. He once said it was his goal to die owing the IRS millions of dollars, which he fulfilled. But it's interesting to me because Lansky was kind of a mentor to Roy Cohn, and we're sitting here talking about how Meyer Lansky didn't own anything, but he used people as almost shell companies. Yeah, I think that's probably what Lansky did. Do I think Meyer Lansky lost a ton of money? Yes. Do I think he was still smart enough to have a bunch of money put away in places that couldn't be touched? Absolutely.
I think what happened was, this is a simple case of, I think the family is taken care of fine. And do I think he died worth hundreds of millions of dollars? Absolutely not. But I think that his family probably lives pretty well.
Yeah.
Like most gangsters' kids do. You think John Gotti's kids have any issues? You think Vincent Gigante's kids have any issues? No, because ultimately all that these guys are doing, look, ultimately Meyer Lansky did all this for power and for money and for respect, but you know, he did it because eventually he was going to die and he wanted his family to be taken care of. Now, do I believe he had only $57,000 in cash at the time of his death? I guess it's possible. I mean, liquid.
Well, I can say that you're right.
Liquid money, maybe.
Yes. That may be all he had in bank accounts. Do I think if Meyer Lansky needed $1 million the day before he died, he could have gotten it? Yup.
Sure. And there was many places in New York that Meyer owned, whether it was real estate and things of that nature. So I think in the grand scheme of things, like in our terms, like I feel like he was rich, but for what he had did for the stuff that he was a part of, he probably should have been way richer. But we can't ever talk about the fact that if not for Castro, Meyer Lansky would have, in all likelihood, have become a billionaire. I mean, for sure. I mean,
yeah, if not for Castro, I mean, good Lord, what he probably turns Cuba into is an enormous vacation mecca for people all over the world.
Well, today, you know what Cuba would be today, Blackjack? It would be Macau, which is what Macau is in Asia.
It would be an enormous draw. So, yeah, it's... You know, Castro really fucked everything up.
I mean, think about it. He didn't die until 1983. Castro takes power in 1960. So let's say, so that's about 20 years that he would have had of control of Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sure he would have been a billionaire. I don't know of any other billionaires. I mean, I think in money made, I think probably Tony Salerno would probably come close. But yeah. But yeah, as far as like actual, like, you know, what you have that's yours, I think Lansky would have probably been a billionaire. So when we look back on everything, so he comes over in 1904, the son of an immigrant. He kind of always meets the right people, whether it was Ronald Rothstein, whether it was Lucky Luciano and the fate that they had. Interestingly enough, though, obviously in 1983, I mean, he was the last of them. You know, Lucky had died about 10 years earlier. Bugsy had been killed about 40 years earlier. What's the legacy of Meyer Lansky, Blackjack? Do we look at it and say, well, I think he was a great businessman, obviously.
Yeah.
No one saw Castro coming. And you have to wonder, again, like I said, what he would have been without Fidel Castro coming in. But he was really a visionary, a guy that was a titan. He made tons of money. He was not Italian, but he was afforded the same respect as any Italian would. And he was right there with his boyhood pals throughout, just kind of taking what they wanted. And he went a different way and kind of made money through business as opposed to cracking heads.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously his legacy is that of a successful businessman. You know, he certainly had a hand in building Las Vegas. But I think realistically, when I think of Meyer Lansky, the first thing that comes to mind is he's probably the top non-Italian figure in the American mafia.
For sure. And the crazy, you know, obviously he's not made and he would never be made, but yeah, non-Italian, it's not close. I think he's definitely number one. I put him and Jimmy Burke up there, and he's above Jimmy Burke. It's that simple.
Yeah.
A fascinating person, a fascinating two people. Luciano and Lansky are, I think, if you talk to most people that know what the mafia is, what are they going to mention to you? They're going to mention Al Capone or John Gotti, right? And people know who Lansky is and who Luciano are, but they don't really know who they are, right? Like, I think if you ask most people, they would have no idea that Luciano literally created the mob as far as the organized mob in America. Right. And I'm glad that we have this show because we can do these long-forming things and you can find out things you didn't know. But, I mean, as far as gambling, there was nobody bigger than Lansky. Nobody.
Nope.
That simple. He is probably credited for, I'm pretty much, gambling in this country. It's pretty simple. And he didn't really even do it in this country, crazy enough. Let me ask you, Blackjack, I think I've asked you this. Did you see the new film called Lansky?
I have not.
The Keitel
yet.
Version?
I have not.
I haven't either. There was a night, maybe it was, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago where I saw it and I watched about 10 minutes and I ended up falling asleep and I haven't given it another shot because I was just watching other shows, but after doing this, I'm definitely going to check it out. I like Keitel. I think he's a good actor. So yeah. I think it's really kind of set in his later life and he kind of retells his story to a young newspaper writer or film guy or something. I don't know, but Lansky was a hell of an interesting guy and that's for sure.
Sure was.
Meyer Lansky on the Sit Down. Make sure you go check us out on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Check out all of our shows. Make sure if you're listening on iTunes or Spotify or wherever, and you can rate the show, please give us a 5. Let us know what you think. Guys, one thing I'll ask, and I mean this, you know, if you have a really like a random person you want us to talk about, feel free, but I'll just ask that people stop sending me people to talk about. Like we will get to them, I promise. We only have 1 week at a time. I can't talk, Blackjack, about how many times over the last month I've been asked about when are we going to do Raymond Patriarca? When are we going to do Meyer Lansky? When are we going to do Vito Rizzuto? Like, we're going to get to all of them, guys, I promise. And it's like when I do Q&A, it's like I get 3 or 4 questions of, hey, when are you going to do this person? It's like, we will. I promise. We've got many weeks, many months, and many years, hopefully, to do it. And we're going to get to everyone, Blackjack. It'll almost be interesting, Blackjack. On our last show, how will the show end, I wonder, right? Like, who's Do we just put a bell on all this?
No, one of us has to get clipped.
Yeah, or go to jail.
I mean,
knock on wood. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But, you know, I got an interesting DM, Blackjack, the other day, and then we'll get on out of here. Someone sent me a DM, and they said they have an idea for a new show that we could do someday. Uh-huh. And I want to read you the DM. If I can find it here. Oh, shit. I got to find it. It was something along the lines of, you should do a show called Tales from ADX or something. And I was like, okay, we'll explain. He's like, you do like a show you do now, except you only talk about like the sheer criminals that are in ADX. Because they would obviously be like the most terrible criminals in our country.
Worst, yeah.
And then he goes, first person should be Ramzi Youssef. And I'm just like,
I don't know about that.
I don't know. I don't really want to do a biography on Ramzi Youssef, for God's sake. But yeah, I'm always interested in different show ideas and show people. But we will get to them. We promise. Blackjack, good to hear from you as always. By the way, did you see you made the Twitter bio now?
I mean, I'm flattered.
We had to put you in there. I felt like it was time.
I think I've earned my stripes.
You have. You've earned your button. So, by the way, one other thing. Speaking on the old timers, did you see that Al Capone's house is not going to be torn down?
It did.
Somebody actually bought it, and yeah, I heard that the local people down there were up in arms. They didn't want it to be knocked down. It was a historical place that they wanted to keep. Also, they had the auction for his worldly possessions. A Colt 45 that Al Capone would call Sweetheart would sell for $860,000. That would be a hell of a thing to have, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Man, that would be awesome to like put above your mantle or something. God, that would be sweet. Would. Okay, we are out of here. Blackjack, I think what we'll do next week is we'll probably get in. I think you know who we're going to do next week. I think we're going to do Matty the Horse Ionello. And the reason we're going to do Matty the Horse is I know we could do Vito Genovese and I know we could do these other guys in the Genovese family, but I want to do Matty the Horse because I want to talk about this Jimmy Galanti story on Netflix that has a connection to, I get a lot of questions about this Galanti guy. Have you seen that documentary?
Which one?
So it's on Netflix called Crime and Untold Punishments, I think.
No, I don't think I have.
It's a couple different storylines. And one of the storylines is about this guy that was a garbage magnate up in Connecticut. And he was kicking up to Matty Ionello. And a lot of people, it's become really popular. He ultimately would buy his son a hockey team. And I urge you to watch it. It's on Netflix. Definitely. So we're going to talk about Matty the Horse. And I want to talk about him because he was really instrumental in a lot of things that have happened in Cosa Nostra history, including the murder of Joe Gallo. He ran Times Square and like Vice in Times Square, made a lot of money for the Genovese family. So we're going to talk about him and that documentary next week. So make sure you tune in for that. I am Jeff Nadeau. He is Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.